Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. 50 years after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., just 1 in 10 African Americans think the United States has achieved all or most of the goals of the civil rights movement. Americans overall were only slightly more optimistic. That's according to a recent poll by the Associated Press, NORC Center for Public Affairs Research. Today, on the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's death, we'll talk about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., his legacy, and the future of the ideals he so eloquently articulated and strove for. Our guest for the hour is Dr. Forrest Crawford, professor of teacher education at Weber State University and founder of Utah's Martin Luther King Jr. Human Rights Commission. Dr. Crawford came to Utah from Oklahoma in 1972. We'll get his thoughts. We'll also be joined by Jason Gilmore from USU, who's in Memphis. Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. 50 years after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., just 1 in 10 African Americans think the United States has achieved all or most of the goals of the civil rights movement. Americans overall are only slightly more optimistic. That's according to a recent poll by the Associated Press and NORC Center for Public Affairs Research. Today, on the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's death, we'll talk about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., his legacy, and the future of the ideals he so eloquently articulated and strove for. Later in the program, we'll be joined from Memphis by Jason Gilmore, USU Assistant Professor of Communication Studies. He's going to call in. He's there in Memphis with some students as a part of King's Road, 2018 USU Civil Rights Pilgrimage. And our guest for the hour is Dr. Forrest C. Crawford, professor of teacher education at Weber State University. He is a founder of Utah's Martin Luther King Jr. Human Rights Commission, has lived in Utah since 1972, originally from Oklahoma, where he grew up in a largely segregated community, attended segregated schools and churches. And Dr. Crawford is going to reflect on Dr. King. Dr. Crawford has worked at Weber State University for 41 years. He co-founded and helped establish a number of organizations like the Weber State University Native American Symposium, Delta Sigma Theta, a professional society for African American women, and the State Martin Luther King Jr. Human Rights Commission. He's presented papers and lectured worldwide, was elected Secretary General for the International Society for Teacher Education. He's a notable voice in Utah education and civic life. And it's a pleasure for us to welcome Dr. Crawford to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. So we're going to do some specifics. We'll set the scene, hopefully, as Professor Gilmore calls in from Memphis. I just wanted to start the conversation with your general thoughts. This is the 50th anniversary now of that momentous moment in Memphis, 1968. Your thoughts, I guess, maybe go to the past, present, and future. Where do your thoughts go as you think about this anniversary?
Yeah, thanks for that question. Well, you know, a 50th anniversary, I think is a perfect way, really, to for all of us to stop, pause, and reflect, and to see where our progress has really taken us over the years. As I think about the time that has passed since his death, I feel very surreal about the awesome task of how far we need to go. But at the same time, on reflection, how significant Dr. King's life and legacy really was. I mean, I think that at the time that he was acting in various communities, that a lot of us took for granted that, you know, he was just part of among many men and women who were being civically defiant, you know, against Jim Crow. And so I think what 50 years, in my hope, should do throughout the day is to help us to understand in reality how important this great American was to democracy.
I want to talk a little bit about your background. You were raised in Oklahoma?
I was raised in Oklahoma, actually a little town right outside of Tulsa, Oklahoma, called Sand Springs. And this community, as you had mentioned earlier, it was largely a segregated community. So I actually grew up in my early years, going to an all-black school, Booker T. Washington, neighborhood school, went to a predominantly African-American church, and the community that we lived in was was largely reflective of black life during that time. So we were well entrenched in some of the national activity that was taking place, you know, during that time. My parents and certainly my older brothers and sisters were very much activists and understood even more so what was going on and their involvement and role in the civil rights movement of the time. I think, as I recall, I was roughly about a sophomore, junior or so in high school when King was at the height of his activism, and so we knew about King. We didn't learn as much about King in high school, but where, you know, we actually got received what I always refer to as our truth-telling. We always got our truth-telling actually from the church. You know, that's where the local black ministers felt the most comfortable in sharing the raw you know, the raw experiences that was going on that was ultimately impacting our local community, but certainly the national.
That's interesting. The truth telling that the ministers felt in church felt most comfortable opening up. I wonder what would the coverage have been in the town newspaper? Would it maybe been different?
You're asking whether the town newspaper would treat it different?
Yeah, about the civil rights movement, were they? I guess there'd be a different slant on things.
Okay, I see what you're asking. Yeah, you know, I think that the paper and I mean, I stand corrected on it because I'm just trying to reflect back whether the local paper, for example, you know, covered such an event, and I believe they did. I just think that you know, sometimes the difference is the depth and breadth of passion for how people were translating the civil rights activism of the time. And so it was more meaningful for us, for example, because Dr. King was our voice. He was our identity. He did articulate in a clear and compassionate and passionate manner how America ought to be. I believe that his legacy really was about how America ought to be. And they interpreted it as communism. They interpreted it as radicalism. And maybe there was some combinations of those things therein. But I think that ultimately, when you step back and look at the larger picture, he was really putting democracy up to the face of America and saying, we can do better and we can be better.
Yeah, you raise a good point. At least looking back, you know, 50 years later, we've been hearing a lot of his speeches as we approach the anniversary. You know, very eloquent, articulate, but it's, you know, today listening to that, it's irresistible. And I think in part because of what you said, he's just articulating the American ideal and pointing out that we haven't yet reached it.
Oh, absolutely. In a lot of ways, Dr. King and his, for lack of a better word, gospel radicalism, because I say gospel radicalism because he really embedded his activism in the Christian faith and the Christian belief system. Because think about it, you know, Dr. Martin Luther King really was Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. So he was a pastor before he was anything else. And so part of what he was able to do is to really entangle, for the lack of a better word, to entangle the virtues of Christian belief and spirituality into the notion of emancipation and how Christ as an example for how we ought to transform our own communities, our own lives, and be more humane with each other.
So I'm wondering what the you say your family some members of your family were involved in you know, activism and such. What were the issues there in Oklahoma? Were they similar to the issues nationwide? What were you fighting for?
Right, similar to some of the issues that were national, but on the local level, what I remember most was the searing the searing reality of segregation in that community. That Booker T. Washington Neighborhood School at that time, that, you know, we were dealing with secondhand books, secondhand band equipment, secondhand laboratory equipment, and so forth and so on. In other words, we felt the full sting of Jim Crowism in Sand Springs, Oklahoma. Now, while some of that may have been up on reflection, kind of benign neglect, where some of the larger community, didn't really feel the sting of segregation in the same way that we did. In other words, they felt like that, you know, as long as the black community is getting along with everybody else, and that we really don't have the problems here. So, in other words, my point is that they were really not treating in a sincere and authentic manner the reality of the sting of segregating conditions.
What were your feelings? What's your memory of the assassination? You would have been a teenager, I think.
Yeah, I think as much as I can remember about it, that I might have been just returning home from a track meet or track practice or something like that, and of course it had hit the black community in a profound way. Where they would say that Dr. King was killed. I remember my mother and some of her friends talking about it at the time. But what I remembered, as much as I can remember, is first of all feeling real tense about the situation. You know, that there was a really a thick sense of resentment in the air. And then I remember feeling fear, you know, what was going to happen to our leaders in our own community? What was going to happen to the national leaders who had emerged as our voice at the national level? But then I also remembered feeling angry that it wasn't right that they had to take this man of God who spoke of spiritually uplifting communities, but also spoke about America's greater self that we had largely disconnected from and compartmentalized in a way that they were saying that this is who you are, this is your community, versus this is who we are and this is our community. So we conveniently sort of disconnected ourselves from the rhetoric of what democratic life should be about in our Constitution.
If we look back on history, you know, it's this temptation to see it as linear, as inevitable, but of course it's not. And looking back, at least this is my perspective, you at least in comparison to other parts of the movement, Malcolm X and others that came later, Dr. King was, you know, not radical, but of course he was seen in some circles as very radical. And I want to quote you. We're talking with Forrest Crawford from Weber State University on the program today, anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s death in Memphis. And later on, we're going to be joined, hopefully, by Jason Gilmore from USU. He's in Memphis. But I'm looking at thehistorymakers.org, which touts itself as the nation's largest African-American video oral history collection. You can look them up and look at Dr. Crawford's interview with them. And they have a section of favorites, and you list your favorite quote, "Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has, and it never will."
It's one of my favorites because Frederick Douglass, who's one of the great abolitionists of the time, was helping us to understand that, you know, if we want to change our conditions, if we want to change our culture, if we want to change society, that part of what we have to do is to engage ourselves in a struggle. And in that quote, it says that you know, whenever you want change, that struggle goes with that change, whether it's a moral struggle, you know, whether, you know, whether there is a cultural struggle, you know, anytime there is a struggle, you know, for change, you know, there has to be, you know, some kind of of anguish and growth that goes along with that. And so if you want the power to be able to make decisions to change your conditions, that part of what you're going to have to do is to participate in the pain of making that change happen. And that's why he goes on to say in that quote that power concedes nothing, that you don't make a change unless you act and be deliberate about, you know, what you want to happen different. So when he says that power concedes nothing without a demand, that ultimately what he's saying, that not only do you fight for that power, but you demand your conditions to be different than they are. And so I believe that Frederick Douglass and certainly others throughout history, other men and women of that struggle during that time, had made equally eloquent assertions about what it is, what it means to demand your conditions to be different than the present situation that you're in.
Let's take a break. When we come back, more with Dr. Forrest Crawford, and we'll be joined shortly by Jason Gilmore, who'll be calling in from Memphis. He and students are at the site of the Lorraine Motel there. They're on a civil rights pilgrimage right now. Dr. Crawford is professor of teacher education at Weber State University. He's a founder of Utah's Martin Luther King Jr. Human Rights Commission. And Dr. Crawford, I understand, instrumental in getting Utah's holiday, right? Martin Luther King Jr. Day?
There was a lot of us involved in that effort, certainly, and there was some point people who were I would say, more significant than my role in it, but it was a lot of us that were on Capitol Hill that was lobbying for the establishment of the holiday. you know, from that time period, 1986 up until the early 90s, that you had a significant amount of citizen lobbying efforts that was going on. But you had individuals like the NAACP as an organization that took a significant lead in making sure that the holiday was established, and that you had other notable leaders who were stepping forward to say that Utah ought to be a state that comes into the fold, that nationally recognizes the significance of this man's legacy, and not relegate him to the fact that King had nothing to do with the state of Utah. And I, one of the things that I was able to do, because I beg to differ, is that there was a gentleman, he's no longer living now, but he was a professor at University of Utah, named Dr. J.D. Williams. I remember going up and interviewing him, back in the late 80s, early 90s. And he had shared with me, and I'm just sharing the short version of this, where Dr. Martin Luther King had actually arrived and spent time in the state of Utah. Back in 1961, he was invited by the, I guess it was the student government at that time of the University of Utah student government. And he actually made a keynote address back in 1961 when he was just emerging as a leader. He was at that time of his life, you know, I guess he might have been roughly, I don't know, 25 or so. He was, you know, really not seeking leadership in Southern Christian Leadership Conference and a larger movement. In fact, he was very reluctant about being taking the lead in the civil rights movement of the time. But Martin Luther King, yes, he came to the state of Utah, and so you know, Utah certainly has, we have our own legacy with King, and for that matter, the King family that has visited this state on numerous occasions over the years.
Just one more question on this before we go to break, because I brought it up. And you referenced a bit of this. I remember the debate, and I recall there was some pushback. As you mentioned, one of the arguments, so, well, Dr. King doesn't have anything to do with Utah, but there were some other arguments that I heard. One of the arguments I heard, well, Dr. King, well, you know, had some flaws, you know, not a perfect man, so why are we honoring him? And there were several arguments that were articulated against making a holiday in Dr. King's honor.
Yeah, I recall some of those, but it was almost as if we were, you know, treating Dr. King from a, you know, very sanctimonious, holier than thou perspective, as if the only way that we could consider him to be a part of American history and a part of Utah history was to make sure that he had no flaws whatsoever, and you know, I along with others said that we need to only look at our own history in Utah and the character flaws that individuals had who emerged to be great leaders in the democracy and the great leaders of establishing Utah as a state. And so so I guess as we were advocating for King to have more of a presence, his legacy, that it was to be more of a presence here. That part of what we were saying is that Martin Luther King Jr. in the totality of who he was and what he stood for was larger than even than the actual life that he led. I'm not suggesting that he was reckless in his life. You know, the FBI of the time could tell you a whole lot of what they might have dug up about Martin Luther King, and I think those files might even be open by now. But they was digging up a lot of stuff, communism, so forth and so on King and many, many others during that time. But part of what our community was interested in is we were trying to decide who ultimately is able to articulate the merits of emancipation in a way that the black community and, in fact, the national communities, you know, would feel like that they are an equal part of society, that that we understood that historically that there were certain times throughout our history where our promises made were not promises kept. And so we arrived at a time with Dr. King becoming that emerging as that central voice. We arrived at a time where we said, you know what? It's time for America to keep its promise that it made. And it should not only involve African Americans, but it should involve all citizens, and particularly those that have been marginalized.
As we go along, I want to take us to the future, and has America's promise been realized? There's some pessimism, not only from African American community, but Americans as a whole. We'll defer the break a little longer because we do have Jason Gilmore on the line with us. Jason Gilmore, you'll recall, is assistant professor of communication studies, and he, along with students, are in Memphis right now on a civil rights pilgrimage. Jason Gilmore, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, what's the scene there? Where are you?
I am about a half a block from the Lorraine Motel in downtown Memphis, right behind the National Civil Rights Museum, we're just watching as people flood into the scene.
Are there events happening, or just people are gathering because it's the 50th anniversary?
Yeah, so it's definitely an organized event. There are a number of speakers who have already begun. Right now there's a performance of young children who are kind of doing an interpretive dance about unity and inclusion. And throughout the day, there will be spoken word, poetry, and a number of other events. At 6:01 p.m. Here in Memphis, there will be a joint ringing of the bells. For those who don't know, 6:01 p.m. was when Dr. King was shot on April 4th, 1968. And so the city will, actually not just the city of Memphis, although we should be able to hear it throughout this city, but cities throughout the country, and I'm guessing throughout the world, will do so as well.
And you're there, Jason, with some students, right?
Correct.
This is a civil rights pilgrimage. What do you hope the students learn, feel, get out of this?
That's a question I could probably speak to for about 3 hours. Mm. We come here as student journalists. We come here as students, all of us, even the professors, to take this as a learning moment, as a time where we need to understand the different voices that are being brought to the conversation around issues of civil rights. And so the idea is that we spend time, we speak with people, we work as UPR journalists to hopefully be able to bring back the stories to Utah and beyond.
So again, what's the feeling there? What's the mood of the crowd there at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis?
It's just getting started at this point in time. People seem to be there's definitely a buzz of excitement as people come in. A number of people are going into the museum, and most people are just gathered around and watching the speakers at this point in time. So it opened up not too long ago, so people are still kind of making their way into downtown. Mm-hmm.
You've been to other places on this pilgrimage, have you?
Yeah, so prior to here, we spent time in Atlanta, Georgia, to kick off King's Road. That's where we went to the King Center and saw his birth home, his first church. We went from there into Montgomery, Alabama, which is the start of his career as a civil rights activist, where he took over as the spokesperson of the Montgomery bus boycott. And we spent a few days there taking in the very difficult history. Montgomery's a tough place because it's both celebrated by some as the cradle of the Confederacy and celebrated by others as a rallying point for the modern civil rights movement, or at least the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s. But the work that's being done there today is, I would say, continuing that legacy. And then yesterday we spent time in Birmingham. And for those who don't recall the events of Birmingham, that's where they turned fire hoses and attack dogs and children marchers. And then we made our way to Memphis.
So this is quite the experience, and students will be doing reports, work for us at UPR. Thank you so much. One of the students quoted in the opening piece here, Anna Peterson, says, "The group I want to focus on," she says, "is individuals with disabilities." I guess different things your students want to focus on.
Correct. Yeah, in fact, the fact that she is interested in focusing on that specific group kind of speaks to who we are as a group, which is a group that understands that civil rights is an inclusive category, right? Civil rights means civil rights for everyone, and her focus on issues of individuals with disabilities really kind of gets at part of still an issue as a society that we're grappling with, that we're still figuring out how to refer to individuals with disabilities, incorporate them in society, and break kind of some of the stigmas of the past. And so each of our students is kind of taking on that role of what they're most passionate about and focusing on that.
Jason Gilmore, thank you so much. We appreciate you setting the scene there. You're at the Lorraine Motel there in Memphis. So there through most of the day in Memphis, will you be?
Yeah, so we'll be here. We'll be here at the events throughout the day. Tonight we're attending what they call an evening of storytelling, and many of Dr. King's friends and confidants throughout the civil rights movement, as well as organizers of movements today, will come together and hash out kind of that same question that we're attempting to address in our UPR series, which is where do we go from here?
Mm-hmm.
So that should be a spectacular evening.
Well, Jason Gilmore, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you so very much. Take care.
And bye now. And, in fact, that very question, Dr. Crawford, I want to present to you following a break. Where do we go from here? The future of activism and the future of the civil rights movement. So we have with us for the hour Dr. Forrest Crawford. We'll take a break. When we come back, more, and invite you to join the conversation at 800-826-1495 or upraccess@gmail.com.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and City Weekly, a local independent news source with event listings, entertainment picks, movie, and restaurant reviews, available weekly on newsstands or online at cityweekly.net.
Next time on Ask Me Another, actor Mojan Marno from the series The Blacklist talks about her role as a shadowy FBI operative.
I think it's always interesting when you get to play a lot of different shades of a person. So we've seen her for many seasons be very tough and very hard to read.
So join me, Ophira Eisenberg, for NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia.
Join us Saturday morning at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Thanks for joining us for Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're reflecting 50 years after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., which happened 50 years ago today. And we've just talked with Jason Gilmore, USU Assistant Professor of Communication Studies. He, along with some students, are there at in Memphis at the Lorraine Motel where the assassination took place. They're on a civil rights pilgrimage. And we're reflecting with Dr. Forrest Crawford, professor of teacher education at Weber State University. He's the founder of Utah's Martin Luther King Jr. Human Rights Commission and an important member of the community. He is asks on a regular basis to teach, train, and speak throughout the state. He serves on numerous committees and boards. So, Dr. Crawford, before we get into reflecting on the future, which I'm sure you would like to do, I'm curious about what you encountered in Utah. You came from Oklahoma, raised in segregated communities there, and I think you came up to Weber State as an undergrad, right?
Yes, I did. As an undergraduate, I transferred actually from a junior college to play football for Weber State when it was a state college. And so I arrived in Utah, on the Greyhound bus down on 25th Street. I always like to tell people that my career in Utah started on 25th Street.
25th Street, yes. That has quite a history, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Quite a history there. But nevertheless, I was a undergraduate at Weber College at the time, and you know, one of the things that was, you know, clear to me that being in a predominantly Latter-day Saint school, you know, I had to raise my level of consciousness and awareness about, you know, what I was experiencing as an athlete, and how I reconcile my a new environment, you know, coming from a segregated community. You know, one of the things that was the unique about that experience is that, you know, being an athlete, I think, lends itself to greater opportunities for a sense of connection and sense of community with people from different cultural backgrounds and geographical regions and so forth and so on. So a lot of the people that I discovered during the time I arrived in Utah were from all over the U.S. And so in quick order, you know, they were my teammates. And so so I think that my transition into Utah was probably less painful than some other stories that I've heard about. But also, as I began to navigate and find my sense of place in the state of Utah, and as I continued my education, I'd never anticipated that I would ultimately end up at, of all places, Brigham Young University, arguably the most conservative, the most white school in the United States of America, you know, trying to earn a doctorate degree. And so that was a whole new, even though I knew I was very familiar and very competent about the Latter-day Saint culture and society, being at BYU was a very, very different experience. BYU Provo is unlike any other place in the state of Utah, arguably. And so even then, I had to make some adjustments, you know, even as a graduate student, saying that, wow, this is a level of trying to understand this community that I had yet to experience, thinking that I had some reasonable level of competence about Latter-day Saint society. But nevertheless, I was able to navigate through that experience, and so where I am in my life now is that, you know, I see my traditional, you know, Baptist upbringing and being a intimate part of the Latter-day Saint upbringing and influence and community, that I see that we care about the same things, that we want to be humane to people, we want people to be able to lift themselves, and while there are certainly cultural and political differences that oftentimes clash with each other, I think that arguably, you know, we want to see Utah continue to become a better place than it is even today. And so, yeah, my experience in Utah was far from traumatizing compared to, you know, even living in my own segregated community, that there was enough trauma in terms of police brutality, in terms of drugs, alcohol, even murder, and those kinds of, you know, you grow up around those things, and there is a hardened sense of how you begin to see your identity within the context of that environment. But you evolve out of that in a way where you feel like that you're in a place where you can make a contribution. And part of, I oftentimes speak of teachable moments to my own students in my classroom, that I tell them that, trying to make our community in Utah a diverse and meaningful community is as part of our democratic struggle is not a straight and narrow road. That it's very jagged, very crooked, and twists and turns and so forth and so on. But nevertheless, we continue to push forward, despite the fact that we live in an imperfect union. But if we want to bring people together in harmony, that it doesn't automatically happen. We have to make it happen. We have to cultivate it, that we have to do something that allows ourselves to make a more diverse society. It is something that doesn't happen naturally. I firmly believe the ideal that that despite our living in an imperfect union, that we can still strive to be perfect, by making ourselves greater than what we are.
I quoted the results of a poll at the top of the program. I want to quote those again now. This is from Associated Press and NORC, Center for Public Affairs Research. 1 in 10 African Americans in this poll think the United States has achieved all or most of the goals of the civil rights movement. Americans overall only slightly more optimistic, think about a quarter of Americans overall. So I wonder, Dr. Crawford, what, and maybe thinking about either nationally or in Utah, where's the biggest area of improvement, do you think? That, you know, we can think about fair treatment by police, by minorities, fair coverage in the media, voting rights, housing rights. Where's the biggest problem, and where do we go from here?
Yeah, I think that the students who are doing the research on trying to make sure that they factor in the disability community, I think is a significant where do we go from here. And I think that that community continually gets to be marginalized in a way that sometimes is either we ignore or certainly not apparent to us in housing situations. For example, I believe that we should be more inclusive of our deaf community, that I think that we are missing out significantly on the amount of talent that is in our deaf community, you know, simply because we don't provide the necessary resources that allow them to come to full fruition as citizens in our community. So I think that part, I'd like to really see that part prosper. I believe that we still have issues with law enforcement, that we had law enforcement issues when I was growing up in my community. We have law enforcement issues now, and so it's, in a lot of ways, it's not significantly different. And so, but I am glad our state Martin Luther King Commission has been among many of the other organizations that's continuing to have these conversations with local law enforcement to try to bring about some awareness and solutions of how we can get along a lot better. But also, I think that what I'm hoping for is, if when you say where do we go from here, that I would really like to see the students who are actively involved in the contemporary marches and protests that we see today, that I hope that they can understand that it's not enough just to stand in the street and hoop and holler and yell, call and response type rhetorics. That what I'm hoping for is that these activisms, these calls to march, really compel our young people to really be able to say, okay, what can we do more meaningful to make our marching in the streets more significant? If you think about the students that, you know, march in Birmingham, for example, a lot of the scholars would argue that had Martin Luther King not been successful in his Birmingham campaign, that he would have never emerged to the level of leadership that he would have. In fact, what I think about is that I think that that's where King really got his groove in Birmingham. That's where he really began to hone in on his philosophy of nonviolence. He saw where students can make a significant difference in terms of their presence in transforming society. I just feel like that students are a key element in this changing our society. But what I don't want to see happen is that we look at these black and white photos and look at I Have a Dream speech and et cetera, and just see those as relics of the past, that these become reflective pieces that propel us into action.
We just have go ahead.
Go ahead. I was just simply going to say that I hope that what we don't do is to treat Martin Luther King and any of the kinds of earlier efforts as a nuanced novelty. My greatest fear is that what we've done is taken Martin Luther King, you know, taking these black and white photos of dogs sniffing at the students and water hose turned on and so forth, that we look at these and we take these images for granted, where we say, oh, that was a horrible thing that happened back then. But all of those images have teachable moments. And so what I hope that we don't do is to treat all of these things as nuanced novelties of the past.
Well, we've reached the end of our time. Much more, of course, we could talk about. And a couple things we advertised that we would talk about, but I think it's been a good discussion. And so a discussion for another time, some of those other things. We've been talking with Forrest Crawford, who's professor of teacher education at Weber State University. He's a founder of Utah's Martin Luther King Jr. Human Rights Commission. That commission's work is ongoing, Dr. Crawford, I think.
In fact, we have a meeting in about 5 minutes.
Okay, all right. Well, thank you so much for the conversation on this important anniversary.
Thank you, sir, for having me.
And we thank Jason Gilmore from USU and his students for sending us reports and for his joining us on the program as well. And we thank you for listening to Access Utah today.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, why is it so hard for some CEOs to leave the corner office?
I don't want to relax too much because I'm afraid that bad things will happen.
We wrap up our CEO series and move on to Chicago and why it matters.
If there's anything we're missing now, it's the middle. You know, what is the middle of America?
It's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
Join us tomorrow morning at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour, it's music for yoga, hypnotic and mesmerizing music for seeking spiritual enlightenment, improving health, and shedding the stress of the modern world. I'm Rosalie Howarth. Join us for Yoga Around the World on the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Join us Friday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Hey, I'm Tom Power. With his old band, the White Stripes, and as a solo artist, Jack White has crafted a pretty proudly old-school image. He bans cell phones at concerts. He makes his own vinyl records. But today you'll hear how he's challenging himself by doing things the new way. Coming up on Q from PRI, Public Radio International.
Join us this afternoon at 1 on Utah Public Radio.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR, Logan, KUSK, Vernal, KUSL, Richfield, KUST, Moab, KCEU, Price, KUSU, FM, Logan. Also heard at upr.org.